Thank you, everyone, for joining us for our first session of the afternoon, day two here at the 45th Annual J.P. Morgan TMT Conference here in Boston. Very happy to have with us Andrew Anagnost. What did you do?
I didn't do anything.
Andrew Anagnost, who is co-CEO of Autodesk. I'm going to turn the microphone, hopefully with less feedback, over to Andrew for any introductory comments you'd like to make, and then we'll head right into fireside chat questions and bring the audience in shortly thereafter. With that, Andrew?
All right. Well, I think most people know we had an excellent, strong quarter. It's basically proving out the momentum that we have in our subscription transition. All of our metrics, we exceeded or met quite nicely. We added 233,000 subscriptions in the quarter for a total net adds of about 186,000. We added $100 million in ARR quarter-over-quarter, which is a pretty good result for us. We added 44,000 subscribers in our enterprise business offerings, which shows just more direct momentum in terms of our overall business. And importantly, we 4x the number of cloud subscribers we have in our year-over-year, which basically just shows how much momentum we're going to have for the things that drive growth for us 5 years out. So overall, it was a super good quarter. It shows a lot of momentum in terms of the things we're trying to do. And what was great about it is the momentum was broad across all the geographic regions, which is pretty important, and across all the product offerings. So pretty happy with the results.
All right. Maybe just to help the guys in the back, we're on microphones 2 and 4. If you want to turn off the other ones, that would be great and helpful. All right. So maybe just to kick off, for those maybe that are newer to the story, you're undergoing this transition to a subscription business model. Maybe give what was the strategic rationale for doing it and kind of where are we in the process?
Yeah. So about 7 years ago, maybe somewhere between 5 and 7 years ago, we basically decided at Autodesk that all software companies were going to be cloud software companies. And we figured that if we're going to get there, there's a couple of things we have to do. We have to, one, start building software for the cloud. And two, we fundamentally have to change our business so that we can sell cloud software price points through our entire go-to-market machinery. So that required us to basically flip the entire company over to cloud-based subscriptions, subscription pricing, subscription price points, and all the back-office machinery that it takes to go to market through a subscription model. So we basically did two things at once. We transformed the business, and we're transforming the products through the cloud platform transformation. And that was a deliberate choice in terms of getting ourselves ready for what we believe is the new reality in software. That's why we started.
So where are we? When we go back, to me, the first subscription transition was Synopsys in 2004. Took about 4 years. Cadence in 2008. It goes on and on. And each one of them, it takes a certain amount of time to kind of go through the customer base and get them over to the new structure, etc. Where are we in that process, and how long before we get into, I hate to use the term, but I'm going to anyway, normalized business where it's all in the subscription model?
Yeah. So we're about 3 years into the process. And for us, it took a little bit longer than Adobe, primarily because we started our journey with 90% of our revenue being delivered indirect. So what we had to do was give a little bit of runway to our indirect channel partners so that they stayed solvent during the transition. So we've basically already moved all of our net new sales over to subscription. There's no perpetual licenses or virtually none, except in some small minority places related to government, perpetual sales going on in our business. So the first important piece of the transition has already been completed as we've moved entirely to all of our net new to subscription. The last remaining vestige of the perpetual model in our business is our maintenance base. As of next month, we're beginning a process to move our customers from maintenance to subscription over a multi-year period. It'll take us probably 2 years, 2-3 years to complete that transition and move those customers fully over to subscription. And by then, the business will be 100% subscription. But essentially, right now, all the new business is 100% subscription. It's just all the renewals are not 100% subscription. But we'll be done in about 2-3 years.
So given you alluded to it, why don't we hit on that? So what is the program that you're laying out to drive that maintenance to subscription conversion?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple program. And what we did is we're taking into account minimization of churn. The main goal with moving these customers from one buying method to another is to make sure we move all of them. So we have a large base of subscription users, over 2 million maintenance users, that we want to move over almost in its entirety. So managing churn in order to maximize the value of that base is a critical factor here. So what we did is we began the first year by rolling out a roadmap of what the price increases were going to do on maintenance and what the customer's options were in terms of moving to subscription. So we were very transparent. We said, the first year, maintenance prices or prices for everyone, maintenance, whatever, are going to go up 5%. The next year, 10%. And the year after that, 20%. So everybody gets to see a clear roadmap in terms of the price increases they're going to see on the maintenance offering. The 5% in the first year was a very deliberate choice to allow the customers time to absorb the plan, see what we're doing, and actually get very focused on asking themselves, okay, what is it going to take for me to move over to subscription? Everybody's going to pay a 5% renewal at this point. A 5% price increase is basically look through for most people. So that gives us time to get them focused on the subscription offering, get us helping them understand what the value of the subscription offering is, and then begin the larger migrations as they start seeing 10% price increases in their maintenance and so on. What they're going to be able to do is move from maintenance to subscription at the current price of their subscription. So for this year, that essentially amounts to a 60% discount off of the current price of subscription. Each year, that price changes a little bit. So next year, the discount will be 5% smaller. The year after that, it'll be another 5% smaller. So the customers that move earlier get the bigger price advantage in moving to subscription. So it's a combination of carrots and sticks, sticks on the maintenance side, signaling a clearer desire for them to be over to subscription, and a pretty good discount on the subscription side in terms of moving over.
You know, as you look at the product portfolio that you've got and where the maintenance subscribers primarily are, because I often get the question, well, geez, what about the users that don't want this? Mm-hmm. Won't they churn off and go to the competition? Maybe help investors understand, of that over 2 million maintenance subs, where are they in terms of the products and kind of where your competitive position? So how much of a threat is moving to the competition even for those people?
Well, first off, nobody is going to churn out in the next year. Like I said, 5% is not an increase that anybody's going to worry about. And actually, it depends much more on the size of the customer in terms of their concern rather than the industry they're in. Our larger customers are already moving off of subscription, off of maintenance pretty significantly because they're moving to our enterprise business agreements, the consumption model. As you move down the pyramid, the customers get more and more pragmatic or more and more dogmatic, depending on the size of the customer, about how they feel about the transition. Customers in the middle of the pyramid, they're fairly pragmatic. They see that this is coming. They see the transitions coming. They're basically evaluating their options and at what pace they're going to move. The customers that have expressed the most concern are our smallest customers. And they're essentially concerned about giving up their perpetual license and not having a perpetual license to fall back on if they stop paying a subscription. That's really one of the reasons why we have this one-year period out there to basically help those customers understand, here's what we're doing. Here's what the value we're adding to subscription. Here's why it's good for you. And here's why you'll want to move to subscription instead of staying on maintenance. Will some of those customers churn out ultimately? Yes, they do have some choices. They have clones of AutoCAD and other types of products that they could churn out to. But we suspect over the next year, in terms of the value we're going to be demonstrating on the subscription side, it's not going to be that many people. There's an emotional response to this that's disproportionate to the actual reality that plays out.
But in terms of quantitative, in terms of numbers, is there a bigger grouping of those smaller guys on either AutoCAD LT or in media and entertainment or in,
the smaller customers are generally LT and Max and Maya customers.
And, where on the, to your point, AutoCAD clones, et cetera, where is, I guess, the closest competition?
Oh, we got you got BricsCAD out there, which is one of the big clones. You got DraftSight from Dassault Systems. We've seen people go to those solutions from time to time, but what happens is they ultimately end up coming back to us because there is a cost they incur not being part of the AutoCAD ecosystem. And based on the question you just said, when you look at the customers that are most likely to churn out, them being LT, or Max and Maya customers, those are not the higher value ARR customers. So when you look at the dollar value of potential churn, it's relatively low. As you go up the pyramid, that's where the dollar value of the churn goes up, and those are the customers that are going to move.
Let's hit on, you mentioned the enterprise business agreements or the EBAs. Again, for investors that are newer to the story, what is an EBA?
Yeah. So an enterprise business agreement is essentially a consumption plan. Think of it as buying a data plan for your cell phone. You know, you got a 100 megabyte plan, a 500 megabyte plan, a 1 terabyte plan, an unlimited plan. And essentially what we sell them is a pool of consumption. This pool of consumption comes in the form of tokens, and it gives them access to the entire portfolio. All of these are three-year deals, so they basically sign up for a three-year deal with a certain amount of consumption locked into the deal, and as they use the software, they burn down their pool of tokens. Certain products burn down one token, other products burn down 10 tokens or something like that. It's a variable pool in terms of what products burn down. They have a band that they can play in, where if they go outside that band, if they burn consumption above their annual target, we just let them do it, and we deal with that at the renewal. They go outside that band, we come back to them, and we ask them to up their contract to a higher usage band. Most of the time, though, we come back at renewal time and say, look, here was your historical usage. Here's where we need to renew you at. The benefits to the customer are obviously they get to consolidate their entire relationship with Autodesk under one agreement that really just allows them to turn on users and turn off users pretty dynamically. The benefit to us is it drives more multi-user and more multi-product usage across the account. So the account, we actually get deeper penetration not only in a single solution in the account, but we get deeper penetration of the portfolio across the account, which basically increases the token consumption over time. So it's a win-win for both the customer and us.
Have you noticed that, and EBAs haven't been around for a real long time, but
3 years.
Have you noticed, you know, within that time frame, a pattern developing in terms of those customers coming back for more purchases?
Yeah, we see about a 30% increase in usage in those accounts when we get to renewal. So they've been around for a while, and what you're seeing now is we're heading into our first sets. Last year we started heading into our first sets of renewals. So we're seeing the renewals, we're seeing the true ups. And because the agreements have been around for just over 3 years, we're gonna see a cascading set of renewals coming over the next few years.
How does the EBAs impact, since we're going through the transition, the income statement is a little bit harder to really grasp the current health of the business. So during the transitions, we tend to focus on things like the number of subscribers, both in subscription plan and maintenance, ARR, cash flow, et cetera. But EBAs, because of their treatment, have an impact on the subscription numbers. Can you walk us through how that actually plays out and maybe some of the seasonality behind it?
Yeah, so the way we actually measure usage or subscriptions on the EBA agreement is through monthly active usage. So each account has a certain level of monthly active use, meaning an individual application used by an individual in a month. So we measure that every month. We collect data from the customer's environment, and that monthly active number, that's what we report as the subscription number for an EBA. There absolutely is seasonality associated with that, more due to the timing of our deals. We do a lot of big deals in Q4, so what you'll see is a large increase in reported usage in Q1 on EBAs because we're basically capturing the usage that was delivered in Q4. The same goes for some of the other quarters in terms of you get this seasonality related to the previous deal, so you'll get some reporting basically on the Q4, Q1 boundary.
So there's... In theory, in thinking about that, depending on the usage pattern within those EBAs, it could also have, one of the other metrics you have is the average revenue per subscriber. Mm-hmm. So from the outside, we only have the point estimates. We could see a little bit of noise, maybe probably not dramatically, but a little bit of up and down just depending on that usage and when that comes on.
Yeah, of course, because what happens with an EBA deal is you book a certain amount of ARR up front, you lock in some ARR, and over time the usage goes up, so you're going to see some variability as the usage increases across an account. But of course, we're always adding in new EBAs at the same time. So there are mix issues and timing issues associated with the EBAs that show some variability in that ARPS number for an EBA account.
So let's talk a little bit about the ARPS, the average revenue per subscription. I described one element that could impact it, but you've, through your analyst day, talked mm-hmm. about some of the levers to ARPS, and you know, there's a period of time where it's declining, and you know, you've talked about the increase. Where are we in kind of the trend? What are some of the key drivers to it? And, you know, longer term, how should we use that to analyze the health of the business?
Yeah, you know, first off, it's the law of small numbers, right? The smaller the size of the subscription base, the larger is its sensitivity is to mix issues. And some of the big drivers of mix are obviously product mix. You get, you know, if you sell more LT versus selling more collections, you're going to get a different ARPS mix. But also one of the other big drivers is how much you sell in emerging markets versus how much you sell in mature markets. Obviously, emerging market subscriptions are sold at a discount off of mature market subscriptions. Monthly versus annual affects the outcome, as well as numerous other slight mix factors. So what happens is, as the numbers go up, these mix factors, the total subscription base, these mix factors start to become less and less of an issue in terms of the trend for the ARPS. So we've been telling the market that as we move towards the second half and into the second half and beyond of this year, we're going to see the ARPS start to trend up. And the reason for that is simply that the number of subscriptions is going up. The discounting level that we've had historically is going to go down because we've done a lot of promotions to try to move non-subscribers forward and get them to buy earlier. Had 70% discounts last year, 40% discounts. You'll only see 30 and 20% discounts this year. That's going to drive it up. You're going to see an increasing mix in collections, more customers buying collections, especially as the maintenance to subscription program lights up. A lot of customers are going to move their maintenance seats over to collection subscription. All of these things are positive forces in terms of pushing up the ARPS. Really, the one thing that pushes the ARPS down, or the two things that push the ARPS down, are, you know, a surge in emerging markets. But as the numbers get large, that becomes less of a factor. And success in the cloud, which actually is one of the things you want us to do. The more successful we are in the cloud, the more downward pressure you're going to see in ARPS. However, we're sticking to our projection that you're going to see ARPS increasing as we head into the second half of the year, simply because of those forces I laid out.
One of the other real incremental things that you brought forward at the Analyst Day was going back and looking at those, you know, non-maintenance, so users that maybe a little bit further back that you think are active. So basically the pool that you can go out and potentially convert. You know, can you update us in terms of how big is that pool and what are the contributors to that pool?
Yeah, so we know there's just over 2 million active users in this non-subscriber base. So these are people that bought software from us in the past. They're anywhere from 2 to 7 years back, sometimes a little bit more, and they haven't paid us in a while. So what we've been doing, there's several things we do to move these customers forward. The first thing we do is the rate at which we're updating the core products that are on subscription is accelerating. So the ecosystem of current product is moving more rapidly than it ever has in the past, which means that any customer that's left behind in a what we call legacy mode is rapidly falling behind the ecosystem, both in terms of functionality and compatibility. The other thing we've been doing is we've been integrating more and more cloud into the subscription offering. And there's some inherent value to the customers that are not on subscription that they're missing out on, and they are not going to be part of a cloud-connected ecosystem, which is going to put pressure on them. And the last bit is what we've been doing short-term to move these customers into acting earlier was the promos, where we were giving them 3 years for 70, 40, and 30% discounts up front if they turned in their perpetual license. Those promos, Sterling, are going to become less and less important, and those other two factors I outlined are going to become more important as we get further and further away from the date that we stopped selling perpetual software. It was 18 months ago we stopped selling standalone perpetual products. As we move into next year, it's going to be over 2 years. The pressure on the individuals that are not current is going to be going up pretty significantly. And you're going to see more of those people coming back into the ecosystem, regardless of whether or not we're running promos.
I want to make sure we clarify. So I think at the Analyst Day, you talked about 4 million users that are non-paying in developed markets.
Pirates. Those are pirates.
Oh, okay. Well, so if we really expand, because that's where I want to head, given that more and more of the feature functionality is being delivered through the cloud or is cloud connected, it would seem like finally you have the stick to bring them into compliance.
I know it's probably tough to measure, but what percentage of those types of users are eligible or potential for subscriber?
Well, first, let's talk about the size of the pirate base, and then I'll talk about what we do know and don't know about in terms of their motion. So there's 12 million active pirates worldwide. That number is not a guess. We know they're active because the software tells us that they're active. Of those 12 million pirates, 4 million are mature markets where it's easier for us to engage in compliance activities and actually, you know, protect copyrights and where the law is more friendly to getting people legal. If you look down even further in that mature market, there's about 1.1 million pirates that are in accounts that we've already sold software to. So when you look at the progression of how we move up the tree here, you go after the 1.1, you go after the 4 million, and ultimately you go after the 12 million as the legal climate improves over a five-year period. So there's a large pool there, large pool of users that aren't paying us anything. In terms of being able to measure our impact on them, look, what we're doing right now is we're providing the license compliance teams we've had out there for years better information. We're basically targeting customers more effectively, giving them much more insight into who's pirating the software and who isn't. And that's allowing them to be much more effective, higher conversion rates on piracy conversion, higher success rates, you know, more subscribers. Long term, we're going to mechanize this, where basically the software is going to tell someone they're a pirate, and give them purchase options immediately. How they show up in our run rate, nobody checks the box that says I'm a pirate as they buy the software. So it's very hard for us to know how much of our new seat run rate is people coming into the ecosystem for the first time from piracy, but we know it's not a small number. We do know from our high-touch compliance efforts that we're seeing increased volume. That we do know. But from the regular volume, it's very hard to identify them.
All right, I want to pull it all the way back up to the high level for a second, and after I ask this question, I want to pause and see what questions we have from the audience as well. We talked a lot about the subscription transition. Let's just talk about the underlying environment out there for your business across your core AEC, manufacturing, media entertainment, et cetera, some of the new areas. What are you just generally hearing back from, you know, the channel and customers around the demand environment?
Yeah, so what we're hearing is the demand environment is incredibly strong, right? And there's several factors that are driving this. Just underlying health in the environment, underlying health in our core industries that's going on. The price points that we put out there with subscription are creating more demand for our products than our partners previously saw, simply because the upfront costs are lower. And then when you look at the longer-term secular trends, and there's a couple of pretty significant ones in both construction and manufacturing, we're seeing accelerating interest and growth in the cloud offerings. So when you look at AEC, construction is industrializing. It's becoming much more like a manufacturing operation. They're trying to apply product lifecycle management principles to the construction process. So they're essentially digitizing the flow of information from design all the way through to build. This trend is not a trend we've created. It's a survival trend that the construction industry is engaging in order to minimize waste, increase their profit margins, and be more competitive. The construction companies, the big guys that are winning bids, are digitizing their process. So we're engaging pretty heavily with the BIM 360 product line to be part of that digitization and that increase in IT spend in the construction market. That's a long-term trend that's going to play out for years and years, Sterling. The other trend in manufacturing is the rising level of automation that's showing up in manufacturing. I'm not talking about just classic automation of factories. I'm talking about the automation of the design to the make process, what we like to euphemistically call push-button manufacturing. More and more additive manufacturing, hybrid additive subtractive manufacturing, and an increase in the sophistication of robotics are creating micro factories or configurable factories where you can take a design, digitize it, feed it a set of instructions, and without any human intervention, something gets made. Now, that brave new world isn't completely here yet, but it's a secular trend that's been set in motion, and it's a 10-year macro trend that's going to really be a tailwind for the vendors that automate this design-to-make process, which is something we're really focused on.
No, that's great. Let me pause there, see what questions we have from the audience. Question up here. So the question is, you know, where do you see collections moving over time?
Yeah, so we don't break out the percentages. So what I will say is suites right now are a very large component of our maintenance base, and our collections run rate has already, which is the number of new collections we sell in a quarter, is already comparable to the old suites run rate. So when you combine these two facts, that collections are already selling as much new seats as suites were in previous quarters, and the fact that we're going to be moving the maintenance base to subscription, and a lot of customers are going to be upselling or cross-grading their subscriptions, their maintenance to a collection, you're going to see collections represent a much larger part of our install base over time, ultimately larger than suites did.
Question here.
What's the cost? So you gave kind of the discounts and the increases in maintenance, but what would be the increase in cost to the user to switch from maintenance to perpetual?
Yeah, so the question is, under the new pricing paradigm, you gave some of the discounts relative to subscription, but if I'm a maintenance user, what is my absolute increase in cost?
So today, right now, all the maintenance users have seen a 5% increase in price. If they move to subscription right now, they move at that 5% price increase. So they basically move for their new maintenance price. And what they do is they get to keep that price for 3 years if they move now. If they move next year, it's going to cost them another 5%. If they move the year after that, it's going to cost them another 5% above that. Right. And they only get, next year if they move, they only get 2 years of lock-in, and they move after that, they only get 1 year of the price. So it's a fairly attractive program for them to move, and there's a lot of incentive for them to move, especially since the maintenance prices are going up significantly faster than that.
Other questions? Question there in the back.
Has the subscription model changed your customer acquisition costs at all? Like, can we, we've obviously focused on the top line, but talk about like the eventual bottom line impact of this transition.
The one thing that the subscription model allows us to do is sell more of our subscriptions digitally direct. And as you get scale on that, you obviously get some economies there where your cost of sales goes down in terms of going through an indirect channel. So when you look at the low end of our business, more and more of the low end of our business is coming through digitally direct to the company. That is a lower cost of sales than going through a channel partner to sell a lower value product. Ultimately, what we'd like to see is our VARs and our channel partners become a vibrant and strong collections channel. We'd like our digital direct e-commerce inside sales efforts to be much more focused on the lower end of our business and the standalone offerings. So yes, you do start to get some economies there. It shows up much more in price realization than in kind of bottom line costs, because sometimes you do incur additional costs to go direct, but at the same time, you realize a much higher percentage of the list price when you go direct than you would through a channel.
Other questions? I want to hit upon the BIM 360 because you brought it up, because this really seems to be something that's TAM expanding versus what you've seen traditionally. There's also other competitors in that space. If I think about Trimble, I think about your strength coming from, you know, the architect down towards the construction site. They're coming from the construction site on up. How do you see that environment kind of playing out? And who else really do you see playing in that BIM 360 world?
So first off, let's talk about how this is going to evolve. We very deliberately use this term, the industrialization of construction, because that's exactly what's happening. The whole AEC industry has been about 10 years behind the manufacturing industry in terms of the adoption of modeling and the integration of model-based processes into their design. As we look out 10 years into the future, the whole design to build process in the AEC world is going to be driven by a model. And the model is going to flow directly from the individual who designed the building to the individual who does the pre-construction work to the person that actually builds the building. This flow from design to build based on a model is going to favor the vendor that basically drives the creation of the model. That's the way it played out in manufacturing. That's the way it's going to play out in this space as well. Autodesk, obviously, we are the leader in BIM, and we are the leader in creating the model. And we are going to exploit the advantage associated with the BIM model into the construction process moving forward and focus most of our BIM 360 energies on the areas where the BIM 360 model is important. Now, obviously, there's other people in this space that thinks it's important. You've mentioned Trimble. Trimble has bought some tools because Trimble deals with equipment on the construction site, so they view software as a lubricant for them selling their equipment, and they've done some of that. There's other companies out there like Procore and Bluebeam, which was recently purchased, PlanGrid, other competitors out there that are trying to digitize the construction site. But we believe long term, the advantage is going to go to the player that owns the BIM model.
I think that makes sense. So. One of the other big changes over the last year is you've been able to repatriate about $1.7 billion in cash, and you've been a lot more active in terms of the share repurchase. Walk us through the strategy there and what we can expect.
Yeah, we don't really put out targets for our share repurchase plan. We do have approval to buy back $24 million in shares, but we've always been committed to, at a bare minimum, offsetting the dilution associated with our stock programs. Now, we've exceeded that, obviously, in the last few quarters as we've bought back more ahead of dilution. You know, we don't have any targets for that specifically, but you can see what we've been doing and you can see what we've got approval for. And we're going to do the most effective buybacks that we can as we move forward.
And, you know, as I introduced you, I did introduce you as co-CEO. Who's the other half of that co, and what's happening in terms of that process?
All right, Amar Hanspal is the other half of that co. I'm not going to comment specifically on the process. I will say that the board is highly motivated to complete the process. As you know, it's a lot of work for a board to do a search, and I'm sure they're as eager for the work to be over as we are. So they're working hard and diligently on this, and you know, Amar and I have the full confidence in the board right now. We're executing well, as you can see, and I anticipate this process will close out relatively quickly.
Other questions from the audience? I do want to touch upon two other topics. First one's IoT. You know, you did make one small acquisition in the space. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot more companies kind of throwing their hat and into that ring. Where are you in terms of that strategy?
So we did do an acquisition in that space. We've looked at IoT and the needs of IoT. You can see we're much more focused on the industrialization of construction and the whole convergence of design and make. We see our platform play in the IoT space as being an incredibly robust play. That means our cloud platform, where we are providing third parties access to our information and integration to our information so that we can provide connectivity to the whole process related to IoT. That market's still shaking out. I think in terms of our focus, we're much more focused in other places right now in terms of building out new businesses.
Okay, and then geographically, you know, developed versus emerging markets, any difference in terms of the uptake around subscriptions or cloud?
Yeah, well, obviously developed markets, the uptake was faster. But what we've seen a fairly rapid growth in the emerging markets as well with the subscription model. The price points around subscription kind of lend themselves to that. So in a natural fashion, mature markets went first, emerging markets lagged, they've caught up. The cloud kind of follows the same paradigm. Mature markets are more into the cloud, but there's an interesting dichotomy here. Some of the emerging markets, with regards to certain segments of our cloud applications, like for instance AutoCAD 360, which is the mobile version of AutoCAD, that has gotten very large uptake in the emerging markets because of the mobility culture there and the cell phone-based culture that's in some of these emerging markets. So it all depends on what application. The personal productivity applications saw rapid uptake in the emerging markets, even more rapid than the mature markets. The process management applications, like BIM 360, more uptake in the mature markets than the emerging markets.
That makes a lot of sense. With that, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sterling.